This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bob Woodruff is starting to return to journalism. Less than a month after Woodruff became the co-anchor of the ABC Nightly News in January 2006, he almost died in Iraq while on assignment. A band of insurgents detonated a remote-controlled roadside bomb that exploded a few yards from the tank. Woodruff sustained a severe brain injury and was in a coma for over a month. His cameraman, Doug Vogt, was seriously injured too. Woodruff has had a difficult but remarkable recovery. Last night, he was the subject of an ABC News special in which he also reported on soldiers who suffered brain injuries in Iraq. Woodruff and his wife, Lee, have written a new memoir about his injury and the process of recovery, called In an Instant. The chapters alternate between his point of view and hers. Bob Woodruff, Lee Woodruff, welcome to Fresh Air, and thank you so much for coming. First, I'd like to just know, Bob, how are you now? How much of a recovery have you made?
Well, I think it's sped up pretty quickly. From the very beginning, it's just much better now. I'd say every day, every week, I get some kind of improvement where I'm able to speak better now than I did 6 months ago and certainly more than 13 months ago.
And physically?
Physically, there's really not a major problem that much anymore. I think part of it was I was in this tank that my lower part of my body was protected when this IED went off, and the brain at the top is getting better too.
And Lee, from your point of view, how far has he progressed in the recovery?
I would say Bob's 95% there. I'm not much of a statistician, but he is, from the beginning, the amazing thing, and the doctors were amazed by this as well, his personality, the very essence of what made him Bob, was completely intact, which really is a miracle with a brain injury because there's so many things that can go awry. But he's built back much of his language and cognitive function, and his writing's come back, and it's been a miracle to watch.
What's your last memory before the explosion?
Well, I have some memories about us driving down the road in Taji before we hit into the IED that exploded. But what I remember from the time of the explosion, I've only really remembered two little things since then. At the moment that I hit, I just really actually went asleep. I was knocked out for a minute. And during that minute, I saw my body floating below me. In kind of a whiteness. And I had that for about a minute. I don't know much more than that, but that's what I saw. And then I woke up and I looked across the tank where Doug Vogt, who's my cameraman, who was also standing up with me above outside of the tank when it exploded, and he was also injured. He had come down back into the tank. And when I woke up, I saw him staring ahead at me with his large eyes afraid and blood coming down the outside of his head. And that's pretty much everything I can remember. Within 10 minutes after that, apparently I was then asleep, and then I was in coma for the next 36 days.
Lee, what was the physical damage to your husband caused by the IED?
Well, I first saw him when we went to Landstuhl to meet him and Doug. And when I walked in the room in the ICU, the nurse brought me around to his good side first. He was hit on the left side of his body, and so the left side of his face and his head was just raked with hundreds of rocks and dirt and cuts. There were stitches, it seemed like, all over his face, the bridge of his nose, through his lips. His eye was completely swollen up. I was sure that he was blind. And his ear was mangled. It was unrecognizable as an ear. But the scariest part for me, not knowing what a traumatic brain injury really was that his brain had swollen out of his head where his skull had been cut off and looked much like a popover or a rugby ball. It was just giant, and there were tubes everywhere coming out of him. It was frightening.
Bob, when you went to Iraq, what did you want to accomplish there? What kind of stories were you hoping to bring back?
Well, what we wanted to see was exactly what the U.S. military was doing in relationship to the Iraq military. They were starting to pass over power to the Iraqis in several parts of the country, and I wanted to see how that was working, how the U.S. military was doing in terms of teaching them of what they needed to do and training other soldiers, Iraqi soldiers, that needed to take over a lot of these operatives. And that's what we were doing up in the Taji area north of Baghdad. And we're one of the things that was important to me once we discovered what they were doing, that we go into an Iraqi tank, one of the vehicles that they were using to travel around with the U.S. military. And that's what I was in when this all hit.
Were you about to do a stand-up report when it hit?
I was in the middle of doing a stand-up when this thing went off. We had actually just completed trying to do a stand-up, but there was so much noise up there that the sound was not working. It was nothing we could ever really use in a piece. And in fact, Doug, my cameraman, was standing there right in front of me, right next to me. One of the Iraqi drivers said to him, you know, we're coming up to very close trees up here outside the road. This is an area that might be a little bit more dangerous for IED. You guys, maybe you ought to get down in. And we're really just about to do so when this thing exploded. That's all we knew.
Lee, you were describing when you first saw your husband, what he looked like. He was put into a medically induced coma for about a month. Did you see him before he was put into the coma?
Bob was in a coma from the minute that he woke back up and then fell back into whatever state that he was in and never woke up from that moment in time. They kept him medically sedated because when they began to sort of lift the medication, he would get agitated as the weeks wore on. But yet he wasn't waking up. He wasn't following commands. He wasn't able to open his eyes on command or move his feet. And that was becoming very disturbing to them. They very much wanted to lift the medication, but his own brain, his own body needed to be able to have that happen, and it wasn't happening. He wasn't waking up.
And I'll tell you, Terry, how amazing the job was that the military did in this situation, which it does for every soldier and Marine that goes through this over there. First of all, when we got hit, there was a fire of guns going off, and there's a fight that went underway between those who had attacked us with the IED and then started shooting with guns. They got those down. Then they got me out of the tank into another vehicle. From the vehicle, they drove me out to a helicopter. The helicopter then flew down to Baghdad. They looked at me, my condition there, and then they fly me in another helicopter up to Balad, which is north of Baghdad. And that's where they then cut off part of my skull. That was all within 37 minutes of the time the attack happened. That's how fast they got me to the military medical people to help save my life. And it made a big difference in the quality of my brain because they were able to get it cooled down and some of the pressure taken off of it so quickly.
And that's why they removed part of the skull because otherwise the pressure would have been too great from the swelling.
That's right. If you've got someone that's been hit by a massive blast in a place like that, and especially from these IEDs, which are huge numbers of them there now, the best thing to do if you've got a lot of brain that's been shaking up inside, even if it's not cut through in any way, or any rocks that go through the neck and the cheek and everything else, which it did with me, you sometimes need to get that skull off so that the brain can expand and take the pressure off of it.
Lee, when you were visiting Bob in the hospital when he was in the coma, you talk to him a lot. You know, a lot of people believe that somebody in a coma is still capable of registering in some way the presence of a loved one and registering, like, you know, soothing, encouraging language. Did you believe when you were talking to him that you were actually getting through to him?
I knew I was getting through to Bob. I knew it from a lot of different ways. There was a moment when my daughter came in and she played this game with him called the kissing contest, which is something they always did when he was away in foreign places covering stories. And a tear rolled down his eye and we both just started cheering because we knew that he could hear us. And the doctors had this running joke with me because they couldn't get Bob to follow any commands. But yet when I would come in and just talk to him and sort of brush his hair away from his eyes, actually he had no hair, his head was shaven, but just touch his face on his good side, he would calm down. He would visibly calm down, sort of like a spooked colt. And they would say, you must, somewhere deep in his unconscious, he must really, be well trained And I said to the doctors, couldn't it just be that he loves me so much he's willing to do what I ask? And they sort of shot me a funny look. My favorite story, though, and I'll try to make this quick, my favorite story was a letter that I read to Bob from one of his icons, Bruce Springsteen. A friend had passed a letter on from Bruce, he'd heard that Bob was a fan, and Bruce had sent CDs and a note down, and we constantly played Bruce's music, and music was a big healer for Bob. And so I took the note and read it to him one day, and I aggrandized it a little bit. I kind of changed Bruce's, well, maybe someday, you know, I can play for you, to kind of telling Bob that Bruce was maybe going to come down to the hospital and play for Bob and all the soldiers. So I didn't think anything of it, and on the second day when Bob woke up from his coma, he looked at me, and he couldn't come up with a lot of words, so he just kind of said, I need one of those, and he began strumming with his hands, pantomiming a strumming of a guitar. And I said, a guitar? And he said, yeah, I got to be ready. I got to be ready when that boss man comes. And I thought, oh, my gosh, he heard me in the coma. So be careful what you say.
So did Springsteen ever come and perform?
No, he hasn't yet. if he's listening, come out.
Bob, did you have any sense at all that somewhere deep down, unconsciously, you knew that your wife was talking to you, that your children were there? Can you tell at all that you experienced anything like that during the coma?
You know, I to this very day, I have no idea, to tell you the truth, Terry. I don't know if I was listening to them or if I could understand them. But certainly when I woke up, I didn't have any kind of memory about it. In fact, I couldn't even remember the names of my brothers. I couldn't remember the names of my children or any states in the country or any countries in the world. I couldn't remember any of the names. It took a long time of rehabilitation for me to get that. But I think the name of Lee I did remember for sure.
Now, did all those names eventually come back to you, or is it that you had to relearn them? Were you taught them over again?
No. I have not had to restudy all of the English language, but some of it has just come back naturally through my brain. I mean, mm-hmm. Some of them it's helpful if I can have them written down, and so I can see them sometimes in my brain, a word that maybe I can't easily remember. But for the most part, it's just slowly over time been popping back. There's still a lot that I still can't remember.
There's so much, though, Terry, that needs to be done with people like Bob and the soldiers and anyone who's had an accident, because some of it does come back naturally, but a lot of it is through the beginning of the exercising of the brain with cognitive rehab to rebuild those neurons and those connections to those words. The way the doctors described it to me is those words are all in there, those memories are all in there. It's just that the pathways have been sheared off with the blast, and you've got so many brain cells that you don't use. So what you need to do is exercise them, and you have a window of time in which to do that, to reconnect to those words.
But it really depends on where you're hit. Since I was hit in the left side of my head, that is a linguistic kind of area, or my language. If someone gets hit on the right, it's sometimes often more physical about your ability to move your arm, sometimes to see distance out of your eyes. And obviously, having met so many soldiers and Marines that have been injured, and those with traumatic brain injury in this and hit in different places, I can see the different kinds of injuries that they've gotten depending on which side they're hit on.
You know, we were talking about you being in a medically induced coma. Do you remember what your first memory was, what your first sense of where you were and what happened to you was when you came out of that coma?
Yeah, well, since I got hit on January 29th, and then it was March 6th. About 35, 36 days later that I finally woke up. And I remember about 4 o'clock in the morning. It was one of these strange that I still remember. And one of the nurses were inside the room with me. And I woke up, and it was about 4 o'clock in the morning. I looked around, and I recognized that I was alive, and I was in a hospital. And it was 3 hours later, because they didn't tell Lee that I had already woken up. So she showed up, which, like, she had so many day after day after day all that month. She finally came in. Her hair was still wet. She'd come back from swimming. And I saw her walk in, and I said, honey, where have you been? And this was like the miracle that I had woken up, and she couldn't believe it.
Did you have any idea what had happened to you? Did you remember the explosion?
I think at the time I slowly to start remember what it was. I know there was some kind of explosion. I don't know if the tank had crashed or if there was an explosion, but I pretty much know at that moment that it was something, some kind of bomb. In this case, say IED. But I didn't really know exactly what it was. In fact, Lee, over a number of days and certainly weeks and maybe even months, was very slow about giving me the actual details about what I had been through. But one of the first questions I really wanted to find out was how Doug Vogt was, my cameraman, because he was up there with me. And I wanted to see how he was, and I was told that he had actually come out alive and had not been in a coma. He was, had some surgery as well, but his was getting better a lot through. And I was guilty feeling at that moment, and I just wanted to make sure everybody else was okay.
Lee, why were you so slow in giving Bob the details of what had happened to him?
Well, the doctors were very concerned about post-traumatic stress disorder, which a lot of the soldiers and Marines experience, and they thought that I should be sort of carefully meeting out the details of this. In fact, I think it was hours later that we sort of told Bob that he was missing part of his skull. And I remember his hands sort of feeling around at the top of his head in kind of a sense of wonder. And he did wake up really with this filter off a little bit. He was funny. He was glad to be alive. He was exuberant. And I really do think that when he said, "Honey, where have you been?" he really didn't know a lot about what was going on. He just couldn't figure out why he'd been waiting for me for 3 hours and I hadn't been right there by his bedside. As we gave him the details little by little, he would process them all and ask more questions, and the journalist in him often came out. But I think it was a careful exposure for him to see the magnitude of what had happened and how his world had changed.
Lee, watching Bob's recovery, what were the most frightening parts where you were afraid that things were taking a bad turn?
I think probably the most frightening phase for me was right before he woke up, because he still wasn't waking up. And so the doctors and nurses had begun to talk to me gently about maybe looking at nursing facilities, a place to sort of park Bob, for lack of a better term, until he could wake up more, because they had done all they could do for him in the acute phase at Bethesda. And at that point, I really was envisioning, what would life be like with someone who would be essentially like another child in my house? Here was this husband, this strong man, this person that I depend on, and now I would possibly be changing his diapers or, taking the most fundamental care of him in a way I had never imagined.
How were you resolved to behave if that happened?
Terry, I created this character in my mind that I refer to as the General. And part of what the General did is I was not going to come to grips with anything. I wasn't going to make any decisions or put myself in any shoes as best I could until he woke up. I told myself until he woke up and we knew what we were dealing with, could he speak? That was a huge question, because there was a rock that went all the way through his neck, and they couldn't tell what kind of real estate it had hit, esophagus, vocal cords, what have you, nerves of his face. So I kept telling myself, we don't know anything. Don't project. Live in the moment. Truly live hour to hour. And when he wakes up and you know what your deficits are there, then you can begin to freak out.
Bob Woodruff, when you came out of the coma and you tried to start expressing yourself, and there were many times when you couldn't find the words, and there were times when the therapist would hold up picture cards and you had to identify what was the picture and say the word broom or whatever, and you couldn't because the brain wasn't operating well yet. Was it really frustrating? Did you have to deal with a lot of frustration, and how did you manage that?
It was extremely frustrating. There's no question about it. I never thought how long it would go, how long I would have problems. Would I eventually learn these kind of words? I mean, I couldn't even say hammer, or comb, scissors. Those kinds of words, they couldn't come into my mind. And of course, just imagine how frustrating that is to somebody like you and I, who have done this professionally for so long. I mean, just imagine it as well for some 18 or 19-year-old injured, traumatic brain injury kind of soldier or Marine that's had to go through the same thing, of just how frustrating it would be even to them. And it absolutely was.
Can you just give a sense of when you would, take stock of your life and what you were facing, what the balance was between depression and feeling sorry for yourself and feeling lucky to be alive.
I think I got so much of the latter, which is feeling lucky about what had happened and how it worked out. There was time, certainly, of a lot of sadness about what had happened. Not so much, I have to say, my thoughts were not so much about what happened to me. It's what had happened to my family and what happened to my wife and my children. And I was especially worried about my children because they're so young and they don't really understand what could be happening and what will be happening. And that, to me, filled me also with a great deal, not only of frustration, but guilt.
Bob, what's it been like for you to read the Washington Post report about Building 18 in Walter Reed Army Hospital and the problems it had with mold and rats and roaches?
Well, you know, you've got a hospital there. It's going to be, you know, closing down within, you know, what, about 10 years? And obviously it's not being built ahead. One of the things that we all have to understand about this war is it has changed so quickly compared to what everyone thought in the beginning in terms of how many injured would be coming back. So in that sense, so many of these groups are actually overwhelmed by the kind of growth of it all. Walter Reed certainly is one. Well, they've got wonderful doctors and nurses that are working in these ICU kind of situations. And then later on, as things go down the years with rehabilitation, it's also really hard to catch up. And so there's some situations like that where it's happening. For me, I've seen a lot of it in the VA. The VA, in the smaller parts of the country, in the smaller towns, they just don't have the knowledge and the experience with helping those with traumatic brain injuries. And there may be significant numbers of those. We could have as many as 10% of all those that have served in these wars of the Iraq and Afghanistan, which could be out of 1.5 million people, maybe 150,000 that have some kind of TBI. And so you're seeing that in a place like that right in Washington, D.C., where there are some people running behind, even though there's a lot of people working even harder than they did before. But you just got to catch up, and you've got to start looking at it, and you have to have people in the country to know about it so that they can step up their own donations to these kinds of things and to help more people in the situation trying to help to save some of these soldiers and Marines.
Was most of your recovery in Army hospitals?
You know, 5 weeks of his recovery was at Bethesda Naval. And then when he woke up, we were able to take him home up to New York, to Manhattan, right, where he was an inpatient for about 3 weeks, where he again beat their estimations. They had sort of estimated it would be a 6 to 8 week time period as an inpatient. And then after 3 weeks, he came home, which was terrifying at first to me. And he was going every day on an outpatient basis to Mount Sinai Hospital, where he did and still does his rehabilitation.
You know, in so many ways, we've been lucky. Since the military treated me like I was a military person that was injured in this situation, and as I described, the kind of speed that they used to save my life was exactly they would do with so many of the other soldiers and Marines that get in the same situation. I was not treated at all differently. And then once I got out and went out for longer term of rehabilitation, I was able to have my own choice as well about what to do. And we, of course, came some closer to our house and went to a private group, the Sinai Hospital, up in New York to work through my rehabilitation as I went on. Not everybody has that choice necessarily. Some of them do have the ability to get into a private kind of resource. But it's something that we certainly had advantage for, and it's helped me, I think, a lot. Also, just coming back to the job that I've got now and doing journalism again has really helped me mentally.
Lee, you describe how when you were spending so much time at the hospital, your children were starting to get kind of, you know, like glum and resentful because you weren't with them as much as they were used to. How did you deal with that in trying to explain to them why you had to be in the hospital?
Well, we have four children, and the older two understood. It was the twin 5-year-old girls who really had a hard time with why was mommy gone and why were there so many friends there all the time. They knew daddy was sick, but a wise doctor who actually put Bob's skull back on, Dr. Costantino, said to me, he does a lot of skull-based tumors and a lot of tumors. He said, you know, things begin to fall apart at the 5-week mark with families, and he's seen it time and time again. When someone comes to his offices in New York for surgery from Kansas or somewhere in the West Coast, and they're living apart from the family, the 5-week mark, for some reason, is where it hits. And that was very true with my kids. I felt like the center was holding at first. And then really as we crossed the threshold of 5 weeks of Bob still being in the coma, which is ironically right about when he woke up, I felt like I just simply couldn't do it anymore. The kids, the balance of scales had tipped a bit, and the kids were needing me more than Bob. And I felt completely split in two because I didn't know what we were going to do.
But that's when things changed in the hospital.
You know what, Terry? I went to bed the Sunday night before he woke up, and he woke up on a Monday morning, and I had put the children in the van to go to the airport and fly back up to New York with my sister and brother-in-law. And I was sobbing back at the hotel into Bob's brother Dave's arms, and I just said, David, I don't know how much longer I can do this. I don't know how much longer I can live away from my children, and Bob just has to wake up. He has to take it from here. I can't do anymore. I can't stand over his bed and talk to him anymore. I'm hoarse. I can't come up with any more stories. What is this family going to do? And sure enough, when I walked in that next morning, that was when he was sitting up in bed, eyes bright as two little coals, big smile on his goofy face with his shaved head and his sunken brain. And he said, you know, sweetie, where have you been? And I just thought, oh, my gosh, he heard me. He heard my prayers. I can't even believe this.
And you know that period when his memory was not quite back yet and he didn't remember words and names of places or things that had happened to him? Lee, this could be an odd opportunity to put your spin on his past, you know, to reacquaint him with his past, but your version of the stories.
And don't think I didn't think about it, Terry. Yes. I said, oh, you remember me, the most loving and wonderful wife ever. Well, you know, we laughed a lot about that. And one of the things we laughed about, and one of the great Bob Woodruffisms, which we had many of, is he woke up and he was sort of bored, as he said, he couldn't really focus on books too much, and the TV was okay, but that would get boring after a while. And we both really lived like trapped specimens in a house, because without part of his skull, you can't really go gallivanting around outside. And it was dangerous, and he had to wear a white plastic helmet at all times. And that's sort of an attention getter. So we were very much homebodies, and Bob ultimately found himself cleaning up the kitchen, which I can tell you in almost 19 years of marriage was something that just about knocked my socks off, literally. So he would be prissing around the house and sponging things up, and he looked at me one day and he said, I am really anus now. And I said, I think you mean anal, honey, but I like that. So we're all a little bit anus.
Thank you so much, Bob Woodruff, Lee Woodruff, for talking with us, and good luck to you both. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Terry.
Bob and Lee Woodruff's new memoir is called In an Instant.